Franz Kafka is one of these writers that everybody thinks he has read and knows something about, but I don't think most readers really do. I didn't. You know, all of my life I thought I knew something about Kafka and what he was like and what he wrote. And then as I began reading your wonderful biography, I realized I didn't know anything. He was almost a mythic figure. So maybe we can start out a little bit by, well, we have a word that was given to the English language by someone called Kafkaesque. Maybe you can tell me what that means, how it applies to our lives.
Kafka's really the only figure in 20th century literature to have given his name to a word in the language. The only other approximation might be Orwell, where we have the word Orwellian. But that's not as comprehensive a word as Kafkaesque. I think by Kafkaesque, we have to mean the sense of overwhelming intrusion that mysterious forces, uncontrollable, inexplicable forces, make upon the individual life. And these forces are elements which come from any direction whatsoever. They may come from family, they may come from friends, they may come from enemies, it may come from the state. We have no way of tracing where these elements come from. But once they are activated in a Kafka novel or short story, they are almost utterly destructive of individual values. And the really correct use of the term is to see it as a force in the world, whatever its direction, a force in the world that is antipathetic to the will or the determination or the direction of the individual. That doesn't mean you surrender. That doesn't mean you lie down and fall on your sword or you die and so on. You fight against it, but inevitably this element always proves stronger than the individual, and you go down fighting. And I think that is the true use of the word Kafkaesque, to fight against something, but in the end, you can't win.
Can it be summarized, would this be accurate, someone caught in a nightmare dilemma against which he can not resist?
Right, but it has to be something stronger than, let's say, some bureaucratic snarl, where, let's say, you've been given a traffic ticket that you don't deserve and you can't get it straightened out with the Motor Vehicle Bureau. That's not Kafkaesque. It has to be something much more cosmic than that, where you really feel that the forces of the world have come together in order to work against you. Something significant and strong, not simply an isolated, I missed the bus and I had to walk this tremendous distance to work. That can't be Kafkaesque. It has to be much more powerful than that.
Can you give me an example of a Kafkaesque situation in one of Kafka's stories or novels?
Yes, well, the best example, I suppose, would be in his novel, in the novel The Trial, when a man who has done nothing, a man named Joseph K., just the letter K, not the name, not K-A-Y, but K as a letter, finds himself apprehended by some kind of state apparatus, which it's never clearly defined what the apparatus is, but he's apprehended by the state apparatus, and he enters into a whole procedure that approximate trials, and as he goes in deeper and deeper, he cannot even find out what the terms of the trial are, what the accusations are, and certainly not any way in which he can extricate himself. So that process is almost vintage Kafkaesque.
I'm going to pull this mic back just a little bit here. Well, we can say that in reality, a Kafkaesque situation was what happened during the Third Reich, where laws were made up as they went along.
Yeah. Well, I think I think in a sense this whole vision that Kafka had was prophetic of what was going to happen, not only in the Third Reich, but I think all through Europe, that there was going to be a tidal wave of events that would eventually drown everybody in their wake. And this included, of course, Jews and gypsies and people from of every kind, you know, 30, 40, 50 million people. And it was a coming together of forces which had a kind of inevitability to it. It seemed to come as simply part of the way in which the world was now making itself or reshaping itself and devouring individuals in its path.
Use the term prophetic. It certainly was. Here was Kafka, a Jew born in Prague, Czechoslovakia, who spoke German, and he grew up at a time when there was a great deal of anti-Semitism. You point out in the book, a lot of it was in the alleys. There was a certain liberalization of laws with regard to the Jews, but apparently an enormous amount of resentment, and Kafka must have absorbed this.
Yeah, there was all that was, as he was growing up in the 1890s, and then after the turn of the century, after the turn of the 20th century, in the decade or two before the First World War, all of these nationalistic groups, incidentally groups that we see reshaping themselves at the present time, as the communist empire has broken up, all of these nationalistic groups and so on, began to turn toward a kind of folk nationalism, a kind of insularity, and so on. And of course, in that view, the Jews became the scapegoats and the whipping boys. Even though the larger society, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, had liberalized many of the laws concerning Jews.
But I guess we would have to conclude that Kafka was not a good Jew, so to speak. He was not a religious Jew to any great degree, although he, as you point out in the book, he did go to a Jewish prep school before he went on to college and studied for his law degree. But the Jewish influence was never really that strong in his life, was it?
It wasn't, not till the end. By the way, that Jewish prep school really, actually, it was a German prep school where a large number of the students were Jewish.
Well, that's right. They divided it in half.
There was a Czech prep school across the street.
Right.
And in fact, in the Czech prep school, Kafka's best friend, Max Brod, who was a Jew, attended. In other words, he attended the Czech prep while Kafka attended the German. In the German side was more favorable to Jews and more accommodating to Jews. And so there were a large number of Jewish students, but in no way was it a Jewish prep. The professors and so on were almost overwhelmingly non-Jewish. Religion as such did not become important in his life. But what did become important was his identification with the historical destiny of the Jews, particularly in later life as he began to find tremendous sympathy with Eastern European Jews, not with Czech or German Jews, but with the Eastern European variety. In other words, Jews coming in from Poland, in particular also from Russia. And it was an identification with that kind of Judaism without any religious belief. He could not find within himself anything that we would call belief or faith.
Many of your readers and listeners of this broadcast will probably be surprised to learn that Kafka did get a law degree and applied it as such as he worked for a state-operated insurance company. I guess that gave him a first-hand look at bureaucratic nightmares, huh?
Not only it gave him a look at bureaucratic nightmares, but also the nature of the work that he did. It was an accident insurance company, and he was in charge of going out into the field and investigating injuries to workers, so that he would go to nearby factories outside of Prague and investigate injuries that involved the loss of fingers, a hand, an arm, a leg, a foot, or what have you. and then adjudicate between the individual and the insurance company to see what kind of compensation the injured person would get. So that what he saw was and what he investigated was really constant disaster, where there were no safety measures, and therefore people would, you know, they would be working on a piece of furniture, and their hand would go in instead of the piece of wood, and they would pull it out, and there would be a stump, and then Kafka had a case, and that's what he did. That's what he did for a good deal of the field work part of his job.
I believe you point out in the book that he actually wrote some training manuals to avoid these accidents that where the insurance company would have to pay off.
Yeah, he was very sympathetic to the workers, and he realized that they were getting a bum deal. And he very often came down very, very hard against his own company. On the other hand, he was considered to be an extremely valuable member of this insurance company. There were only two Jews in the whole company. He was one of them. And he was advanced. He was promoted. He was well thought of. He was given bonuses. He was given vacations that were completely outside of any kind of contractual agreement. So that he was, in every respect, an enormously successful person in the business world, which is not something that we normally think of. When we think of Kafka, we think of a loser. He wasn't a loser at all. He was quite successful.
Well, he was a successful businessman, and you write that he also was an investor in an asbestos company.
Yeah, well, that went under. That was a family venture that it all remains rather murky. It was a family venture that went under, and his father never forgave him for the loss of money and everything else that went into that. That was not Kafka's kind of thing. While he hated the bureaucracy, he was a very good bureaucrat.
Well, Kafka apparently, as you indicate, was also a fairly good businessman, but he was still a man consumed by his writing, wasn't he?
Yeah. Everything was aimed at the writing. As I point out in the biography, he arranged his entire life so that he would have an opportunity to write. And this meant by arranging his life, I mean not only his free time when he wasn't working, but also his sexual life, the whole sense of whether he should get married, his decision against marriage, against children, against everything that he felt would be an interruption of the one thing in his life that really meant everything to him. And that was to sit down at his desk at about 12, 1 o'clock at night, when Prague was absolutely quiet. There were no carriages going through the streets, no horses, no people. And then in this absolute silence, Kafka would do his writing until 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the morning. And then he would sleep for a couple of hours and get up and go off to the insurance company.
He was somewhat obsessive about his need for silence, wasn't he?
Yeah, noise almost became for him a kind of personal grievance, that people were making noise in order to drive him crazy. It was a part, there's a whole sequence of obsessions in Kafka. Food was another one. Nearly everything that was marginal to the actual writing was obsessive with him, where he grabbed hold of something and then he simply didn't respond, let's say, as a more moderate person would.
I think you point out that he developed a practice. I think it's called Fletcherizing.
Right.
What's Fletcherizing?
Yeah. That's putting the food in. Fletcherizing is named after an American doctor named Fletcher, and who advocated this as a digestive remedy for people who had any kind of digestive problems. And that is, you put the food in your mouth, and then you chewed for 50 or 75 times until it was an absolute liquid or pulp, and then you swallowed. And then you put the next bit of food in your mouth, and you did this again, so that a meal obviously would be drawn out endlessly as you chewed away. And the another dimension to it would be, of course, that it was absolutely repulsive to everybody around you.
I don't even know how he swallowed it. It's like eating Gerber's baby food. Strangely, while he wrote almost nightly, I believe you point out, He published very little in his lifetime. A few short stories, some reviews. Tell me a little bit about his fledgling publishing efforts.
The fact that he published very little has several possibilities to it. One is that he set such a high standard for himself that he felt that he could not publish most of what he wrote. And as you know, before he died, he asked Max Brod to destroy everything, and Brod, of course, did not. So one element would be connected to these impossibly high standards. Another element would be connected to the fact that he couldn't stand to be scrutinized by other people. There was a kind of exhibitionism in publishing too much or publishing too rapidly. A third thing was that a great many of his pieces were never completed. The longer pieces, the novels, for example, were never completed, and therefore they could not be published during his lifetime because, in a sense, they were still on his desk.
I believe you point out that America only had eight chapters.
Eight chapters, and I discovered in the German edition, as opposed to the American or the English translation, there is some additional material. But he felt when he published that he was exposing himself, that he was in a sense undressing himself to the reader, and there was a great deal of pride as well as disdain on his part toward exposing himself in this kind of naked way. There were very few pieces that he actually liked enough to publish in his lifetime. One of them, of course, was the piece, I suppose, that everybody knows best, The Metamorphosis.
Now, there are two elements in Kafka's life that are very important to his development. I think one of them, would you like some water?
That's all right.
One of them, of course, his relationship with his mother and father. He lived at home well into adulthood. Apparently, it was kind of a love-hate relationship, huh?
Well, you know, I argue that he wrote so horrendously about his father, and then there's the famous letter to his father, which is a kind of psychoanalytic document that has come down to us, that what he needed was a very, very strong image of the father, so that when he, Kafka, stood up to the father, he, Kafka, looked very strong himself. In other words, he built up the father into a monster so that when Kafka confronted the father, he, meaning Kafka, could also seem a powerful human being because he took on this monstrous man. I felt the real hatred that he felt was not toward the father but toward the mother. That I argue that he saw the mother as abandoning him to the father, as devoting all her time to the father and not having sufficient time for Kafka himself. So that in a sense you're right. He lived off this by battling constantly, struggling against the father and to some extent against the mother. He had a theme. He had an idea. He had a way of proceeding.
Well, the other major element
is theater, by the way. It's pure theater.
Well, the other major element in Kafka's life was his sex life. You point out that apparently he did have some relationships with prostitutes and was apparently revolted by the sex act. And yet he had quite a number of affairs and a long-running engagement with more than one woman. Tell me a little bit about his sex life and the women with whom he related over the course of his life.
Well, the bouts with prostitutes were not with street-walking prostitutes. They would be mainly with shop girls or sales clerks and so on who would be freelancing at night to pick up a little extra money. In other words, not professional brothel type of prostitutes. In terms of the relationships with women, he had a 5-year on-again, off-again relationship with Felice Bauer, which is a marvelous sequence in his life.
I think you mentioned in the book that the letters to Felice alone would almost make him stand out as a major writer.
Right. They are, those letters, we only have his side of it. Hers are never turned up, and we assume he destroyed them. But his side of it make it for a marvelous kind of autobiographical novel. But that relationship was never consummated. The only real sexual life that he had, and this is going to sound a little offbeat or amusing, is he often went to sanitariums for tubercular patients, and he would have affairs there with other patients, with women there, which sort of opens up the whole possibility that this is where the women were. And since everybody was already infected with tuberculosis, there was no chance of catching anything. The chances are he never consummated a relationship of any kind with a woman whom he knew well.
Well, you mentioned that, and you have a photograph of one woman who claims to have had a child out of wedlock by
Greta Bloch, yes. There is absolutely no proof of any kind that she had a child with Kafka, except her own statement made many years later when Kafka was a kind of legendary, long dead and a legendary figure. But there is no such child came, and actually I think in my biography I showed that by way of chronology or by way of dating and so on, it was almost impossible for Kafka to have impregnated her.
Kind of like a forerunner of the William Kennedy Smith, you know, all these women coming forward. Me next, I did it, he did it to me. You know, they all come forward like that. It was kind of the same thing, wasn't it?
Except when Greta Bloch made this claim, to have had a child by Kafka would have been, of course, you know, a great triumph, because Kafka was entering German literature as a kind of legendary figure.
Now, you alluded to my next question, which was the matter of Kafka's health, which was not very good. In fact, Kafka died at the age of 42, I believe.
40, yeah.
Really premature. Tell me about his health problems and the tuberculosis.
Well, he had the typical tubercular build, and tuberculosis, as we know, was the grand killer right through the 19th century and into the 20th century. It was the, you know, it was the lung cancer and cancer, et cetera, of its day in terms of its killing abilities. And he had the tubercular build. He was almost 6 feet tall. Again, this is, most people don't think of Kafka as being so tall. They think of him as somehow a wimpish, short fellow. He was almost 6 feet tall, and he weighed in the range of about 115 pounds with a very concave or caved in kind of chest, and a very pronounced lack of musculature and so on, so that his health was precarious starting in his 30s. The actual tubercular condition was not discovered until 1917, when he was 33 years old. But before that, there had been an unusual array of colds and complaints and just general ailments and so on, which would seem to be a kind of precondition of tuberculosis.
Don't you point out that he was also considered a hypochondriac?
Yeah, everything was exaggerated. But on the other hand, he was a man who was going to die at 40. So in a sense, he's like the paranoid with real enemies. He was a hypochondriac with real ailments.
Well, his business career had to be cut short by the tuberculosis, isn't that true?
Yeah, after he hemorrhaged in 1917, and he really hemorrhaged with buckets of blood, he began to taper off at his work, and within a few years he was unable to really go to work anymore. The company gave every consideration. They gave him enormous vacations, paid time, every possible thing that could keep him on.
He died in a sanatorium.
Died in a sanatorium. Eventually, he died of tuberculosis of the larynx, which meant that his entire throat structure had closed up, and he was unable to eat or drink at the end.
Now we come to kind of the meat of the story, and that's his writing and his relationship with Max Brod, who I guess was his best friend. And apparently it was Brod who inherited Kafka's archives. So tell me about that. And Kafka was not particularly well known, of course, because he was not widely published during his lifetime. So his notoriety developed after his death.
The only two major writers, of major writers who knew Kafka or anything about Kafka during his lifetime, was the Czech poet Rilke, and the Austrian, the Viennese novelist Robert Musil, the one who wrote The Man Without Qualities. Kafka's reputation is owed almost completely to Max Brod and to Brod's slow publication of one Kafka work after another after his friend's death. Brod brought out The Incomplete Trial, The Incomplete Castle, The Incomplete America, short stories that had never been published before, collections that had been published only once and really forgotten. He edited the journals, the diaries. He made available letters and so on that eventually went into a huge volume of Kafka letters to friends and relatives and so on. So that it was really, really Brod who built up this whole body of work that Kafka became known by, particularly, I guess, his signature work, The Trial. I suppose The Trial is the most famous work, maybe after The Metamorphosis, or even more so.
It was like Boswell's Johnson, or Johnson's Boswell. I always get them mixed up.
Boswell's Johnson.
So he had Brod actually, in effect, made Kafka.
Yeah, he made him, and we should never forget that. Then, of course, he wrote a pioneering biography. He wrote the first biography of Kafka, which now is rather quaint, you know, as we read it now.
Well, what do you mean by quaint?
Well, he made all kinds of claims for Kafka that don't really hold up. He felt that Kafka was really on a religious spiritual quest, and so on. He said he was a happy fellow. He was amusing, and so on. It was a sanitized Kafka rather than the real anguished, agonizing Kafka whom we now know. But it did bring together a lot of information that all future biographers needed. And, of course, Brod is indispensable, even while he's really not to be believed on whenever he enters in with opinions. And his editing of some of the incomplete books is very inadequate also. The editing of The Trial, the editing of The Castle, all of this now has been redone. And redone under much more careful circumstances.
Now you're looking at Kafka as a man of his times, and the forces in his society, politically, economically, and all sorts of aspects as they applied to Kafka and helped to shape him. And I think the book is subtitled "Representative Man." I don't have my glasses. Prague, German Jews, and the Crisis of Modernism. Which leads me to ask you the question: what is modernism, and after defining that, perhaps you can explain Kafka's role in it.
Well, modernism is a large movement that we begin to notice in the 1880s and 1890s, and then certainly after the turn of the century, in which all kinds of changes were taking place in the arts, in literature, in painting, in music, and so on. I mean, just to mention in painting itself, the movement from representational painting toward non-representational painting, toward abstraction, toward surrealism, and so on. or in music, the movement from the melodic line that we associate with say with Brahms and even with Wagner, into the breakup of melody and so on that we associate with Schoenberg or his contemporaries. In literature, the same kind of thing was happening. The infusion into literature of psychoanalytic principles, the use of the unconscious, suddenly becomes creates a vast change in the way in the way literature is being written and the way literature has to be read. All of these shapings and reshapings are part of what I call modernism or the avant-garde. And Kafka was like a blotter, just soaking all this stuff up as it came in from Paris, as it came into Prague from Vienna, or from Berlin, and so on. And he just sort of soaked it all up, and it became part of him. Particularly, of course, that whole world of psychoanalysis and the use of the unconscious.
Who were some of the writers that Kafka may have influenced?
Whom he may have influenced. Well, he influenced a whole generation of American writers. In other words, it took some time, but he influenced a whole generation of American writers who were quite alive and kicking, like Philip Roth and Saul Bellow and any number of them.
John Hawkes. I read John Hawkes, and it just rings of Kafka.
Oh, yeah. These are all American writers who, nearly all of them, Joseph Heller would be another one. Catch-22 is really kind of American version of Kafka-esque, isn't it?
Yeah.
These are all writers who served in the, or nearly all served in the army overseas or were exposed to foreign literature. And Kafka and Joyce, we don't want to leave out Joyce, but Kafka and Joyce became the main elements in their thinking. Then in Europe itself, there are all kinds of generations of writers. I mean, Günter Grass, and then an Austrian writer who recently died who's not too well known in this country, Thomas Bernhard. All these people were in France, an entire generation of writers. Camus, mm-hmm. who wrote extensively on Kafka and was influenced at every stage by Kafka.
Now, Franz Kafka is not your first biography. Of course, you've written critically praised biography of Faulkner, for example. But how different is Kafka from your previous biographies? Have you done a complete turnaround?
Well, the first biography I did was a huge biography of Joseph Conrad.
That's kind of linked, yeah.
Yeah, that's linked. Yes. I mean, Conrad was Polish, Kafka was Czech. There was only a train ride away from each other. They both come out of a Central European background. They both come out of countries that were not countries, that were part of another empire, where Poland was divided among Prussia, Russia, and Austria, and Kafka's Prague and Czechoslovakia was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, so that they're both displaced people. They're writing in languages that are somewhat removed. Conrad writing in English, Kafka writing in German while living in a Czech speaking country. There are enormous differences, of course. Kafka being Jewish and Conrad belonging to an upper class Catholic background and so on. But there are this whole question of the displaced writer, the exile, the writer who feels foreign wherever he is, writing in a language that is removed from either his native language or the native language of the country he comes from, and so on. So that gave me real continuity. I mean, I felt with Conrad, I was Faulkner is another story.
Another biography.
Right. Yeah.
There's so much information. This biography is about 800 pages. How did you approach your research with regard to Kafka?
Well, you know, this is the kind of book that I waited about 25 years to write this. I had planned to write a Kafka book starting when
I... Waited 25 years. Probably took you 25 years.
Well, you know, it sounds funny, maybe presumptuous and so on, but I didn't feel I was mature enough to write a book on Kafka. It's different from writing about, say, another major figure. Kafka is very seductive, and unless you really are certain of your own feelings about things, he can simply seduce you. He can suck you in. The research was really a kind of an accumulation. I had the Conrad got me into that Middle European world, and I learned some Polish. Also, it's part of my background. I have an Eastern European background. And so that I have a very distinct feel for all of this. And then I wrote a book back in the early 1980s called Modern and Modernism, which was about the whole modernist movement in France and in Germany and Italy in particular. And that really provided a great deal of my research for Kafka. And I have a section on Kafka in that book. And with that, the fact that I felt I was mature enough, I began to see my way clear to writing a book on Kafka. What I also had to do was to spend a great deal of time retrieving my German. At one time I had a very good command of German, but I had let it go.
Did you go to Prague?
I went to Prague. I also went to school at NYU in order to get my German back. I went to Prague as a guest of the Czech government, and I lectured there on American literature at Charles University. And while I was there, I did my Kafka research.
Well, it was an enormous undertaking and a study, I'm sure, that is going to be around for a long time by scholars who want to know more about Kafka. To kind of wrap things up a little bit, The Hunger Artist, I was reading that story a while ago. Here is a man in a cage and fasting. And you, right at the beginning, you make reference to the hunger artist. What is a hunger artist?
A hunger artist is a man whose art or his craft consists of fasting longer than any man has ever fasted before without dying. In other words, it's a man who is trying to find out how long a human being can go without food without actually dying, so that each fast requires him to go a little bit past the previous one. And the idea is, of course, to refine the art to such a degree that he reaches the point just this side of dying. In other words, he doesn't die, but he is as close to dying as a person can be. This was the piece that Kafka wrote near the end of his life. And he was reading the proofs of this story at the time when he could himself no longer swallow.
Mm.
So it's almost as if his entire life was the refining of the idea of the hunger artist, of fasting. Of course, he is an artist. Only he uses his body and his willpower as his art.
Well, my last question to wrap things up, as we approach the 21st century, as we move into the 21st century, where is Franz Kafka going to stand?
Oh, I think Kafka now has gone even beyond being a writer. I think Kafka, there's a kind of legendary quality. I think he's almost mythical. When you say Kafka, it's like there's a new movie out called Kafka. Mm-hmm. It's really not about Kafka at all, but it uses the word Kafka as a kind of totem, as a kind of magic word. It's like making a movie and calling it Hitler. And then, of course, you say Hitler and everything comes alive. And you say Kafka and you immediately begin to enter a subterranean labyrinth, tunnel-like world, and so on, that has all kinds of magical, mysterious powers. And I don't see that ever going away. I think Kafka's into that forever.
Beautiful job, Frederick Carl. Franz Kafka represented a man. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.